Here we go. Okay, what do I mean when I talk about reuse? We're talking about using existing code in a new context. And this fits in with what we were saying last time we were together about prototyping. That in prototyping, one of your main goals is to not write code. One way to do that is to use a high-level programming language that doesn't need much code. Another way to do that is to use a programming language with a large library. And I think at this point, I might show you. So, in the slides, and I hate this. Look, I wish it wouldn't keep the old stuff there. I hate this interface. Now you're connecting. At Bell Labs, they invented a statistics programming language called S. At the University of Auckland, they wanted to use something like that for teaching, but they couldn't afford the price of S. So Rossi Harker and Robert Gentleman implemented their own open source version called R. And R has pretty much taken over. Now, it's a programming language with support for statistics, but it's got a library. There's a library of software that you can load. Let's see if there's a New Zealand mirror. Yep, here we go. And let's see, packages. Ka-ching. Now, table of available packages. Okay, so we go. Okay, we haven't finished the end of the A's yet. Ah, there's B. Okay, I think you get the point. There's an awful lot. I wouldn't say that everything you might want to do if you want to do statistics is here, but quite a lot of it is, and what isn't here is at the companion website, Bioconductor, which is for bioinformatics. It's at the point where you need some sort of tool to help you search this list. Okay, now back in the old days, right? Everybody said, look, we've got this problem. There's this huge backlog of programs that people want, but there hasn't been time to write yet. And this is the so-called software crisis. Why were we doing this? Well, because it was hard to write programs, because the programs we wrote were so buggy that we had to spend a lot of time fixing them, because by the time we'd got them written, the customer's requirements had changed, so we had to do it over again. And there were dreams of what would the utopian future look like, and one of the things was high-level languages where we wouldn't write so much code. And the other dream was reuse. People dreamed of the day when there might be a component marketplace, a shop that you could go to that sold modules that you could just bolt into your program and not have to write for yourself. And in fact, the programming language on macOS, Objective-C, was invented by Brad Cox as a hope, in the hope of enabling a component market. He said, okay, now here's this C language that we've extended with object-oriented features, and here's a library, and by the way, that's my library, you can't copy it. And now I want people to come and start making components that we can distribute and we can sell. And people looked at it and said, that's a great library, why can't we have it? And so it wasn't until Steve Jobs got sacked from Apple and set up Next, and he said, well, I want to do Next in Objective-C, and bought the rights, and rest is history. And so Objective-C succeeded in the Apple world, because although the thing had been intended to support reuse, it failed at the first hurdle. The library that was described in the book was a proprietary library, and so lots of people could and did build Objective-C compilers, but they couldn't copy the library. Okay. Well, but that was the dream, and it worked to a certain extent for numerical algorithms. Okay, journals would publish algorithms. You applied statistics, published algorithms. I've used several of those. The ACM and the Computer Journal published algorithms, and you'd have to type these things in. To this day, there's the collected algorithms of the ACM, various other journals published algorithms. One of the things that we were missing was a dominant programming language, a language with a large market. Another thing we were missing was a distribution mechanism. Probably none of you have ever read an issue of Dr. Dobbs' journal, originally called Dr. Dobbs' Journal of Computer Calisthenics and Orthodontics, Running Light Without Overbite, BYT. And they had a scheme where they would print listings in there, anything, but they also had the stuff encoded as barcodes, and so you could swipe a wand over your printed magazine, and cunning, right? Not suitable for high volume code. So these days, we have the storage capacity for lots of code, we have the memory capacity for lots of code. We don't have to, one of the factors in the past was, we were talking about machines that were 4,000 times slower than today's machines. Okay, this machine can operate on a vector of four numbers at once, and it's going at about 3,000 million instructions. An old-fashioned machine would operate on one number at a time, and this would have four cores. So, you know, we're talking about a huge factor of speed. And so if you wanted anything done, you really had to tune your code carefully to get adequate performance. And this is still a factor in some contexts. As I said, I'm on the fringes of the square kilometer array. And in a recent email message, it was explained that they were trying to get permission to use single precision floating point numbers for all of their astronomy calculations. And I said, you know, I'm a bit dubious about this. And the problem turns out to be they've got so much to calculate that they have to use graphics coprocessors to do it, and graphics coprocessors are very bad at double precision. They're much worse than they are at single precision, much slower. So either they've got two choices, either they do it with single precision, or they go way over budget. And the budget already includes enough money to build a couple of power stations. So in that environment, they have where you're working hard against the limits of what affordable hardware can do. Then you have to tune your code. You can't just reuse stuff. You've got to very carefully measure and optimize. But for most purposes, if you want something like a package that will draw business-type graphics charts for you, you don't need a fast machine for that. You don't care if the code's written in something like Java or even Ruby. Okay, fast enough is fast enough. So now we've got fast enough machines, big enough machines, and we've got a distribution network, the internet, that makes it really, really cheap to get software. I mean, yesterday I downloaded a whole new compiler for a language that I want to learn but haven't yet, and, you know, it took a few seconds. I mean, this is crazy, right? This is, for me, science fiction universe. So the economics of reuse have changed. These days we've got so much that we've got to interface to. I mean, if you want, here's web stuff, okay? Have you ever looked at the specification of PDF? Do it sometime. The specification of what PDF looks like is a couple of hundred pages. It is not simple. The easiest way to generate PDF is to generate data from some other program and then generate. So these slides were generated by, here is a program, here is a description for slides, here is a program that somebody else wrote that takes slides in something like HTML and turns that into LaTeX. So the program takes that and turns into and determines the structure of it. There's a small program that I wrote that turns that into LaTeX. LaTeX somebody else wrote, that turns into PDF. And finally, the web browser displays the PDF, and there's a vast amount of software in there. It's woefully inefficient, but who cares anymore? Right? The economics have changed. The important thing is how easy is it to get the result I want, not how much software is involved. So now we've got reuse. We've got it good and hard. And there are some problems with reuse that we weren't quite expecting. So what I want to do is I want to tell you about the good side and the bad side of reuse and something about how to do it. Okay, so what's the point? The first thing is to make our programs better. I like little slogans. Here's one of them. If you didn't write it, you didn't wrong it. If you didn't write the code, you didn't introduce any bugs into it. If you didn't change it, you didn't introduce any bugs into it. Okay? It's still got the bugs it already had, but you haven't made any new ones. And by the time something has been reused in several different contexts and tested by other people, it's pretty likely to work pretty well. Okay. So the idea here is not just that we're using somebody else's code, but that we're using code that's already been tested. Unfortunately, we can't guarantee the quality of other people's tests. And we can't guarantee that just because something worked in one context, it will work in another. And we've got this problem with things like Java. Unless you use strict FP in Java, a Java program that works on one machine might not work on another machine because of tiny floating point differences building up. Certainly if you've got something that worked, I've got programs that used to work under Java 1.5, and I've got to throw them away because they don't work under Java 1.8 anymore. So that's a bit of a pain. So you expect that the code will pass a lot of the tests, a lot more than it would if it was newly written, but you still have the obligation to test that it works in your environment. You're expecting to reduce costs because the code has already been written, but that doesn't actually necessarily follow. If the code doesn't do exactly what you want, then you've got to wrap something around it. Okay, so let's say that you have a program for making concordances of Chinese documents, but that program wants Unicode, and the documents you would want to process were written 20 years ago and are in Big Five, which is another encoding for Chinese characters. Then you've got to wrap something around it that says convert that from Big Five to Unicode, which you can't quite do because there are some characters over there that aren't here. Do the processing, convert back. Okay. So you've got to work around any incompatibilities there might be between the way it wants arguments or data results and the way you need them. You want to reduce the time to market because you don't have to spend the time writing the code and you don't have to spend so much time adapting it. But now we've got time-consuming issues that we didn't have before, that you've got to find the code and you've got to learn an interface which is probably more complicated than you would have written if you designed it for your own purposes. And here's an example. Most modern Unix systems come with a library called libxml2. Now, this is a library for processing XML in C, and the library documentation was both incomplete and not quite English. And I spent about a week trying to figure out how to use it and gave up. It took me one day to write an XML parser of my own. That was over 1,000 lines of code. It was the most productive I've ever been. Of course, I needed to spend another couple of days fixing it, but it doesn't sound quite so good if I say that. And I also wrote my own library for processing this stuff once it's been parsed. And I ended up with fewer lines of code than there were lines of documentation in the libxml. It was actually easier, less effort, less time to write my own than to reuse somebody else's. At Quintus, the company I worked at in California, we bought in a graphics library that was supposed to already work with our language. It didn't. And there were major compatibility issues with it, so that we ended up rewriting it twice. Major quality issues, good grief. And it would have taken less effort to develop our own library from scratch. Another issue is that we want to improve portability. If we're interested in portability, we look for existing components that have already been ported. Okay, so we say, is this known to work in these environments? And if you're told yes, it's, oh goody, maybe it'll work in those environments as part of my program. But you still have to find something. You can't just say, I will reuse this. You've got to find this. Now, the traditional life cycle back in the old days was you gather the requirements. This is the waterfall. You gather your requirements, you turn those into specifications. If we build software that does this, that will solve this business problem. Then you build the code and the test and the documentation. You can do those things in parallel. Then you test your code and we're really optimistic here. There's no corrections needed and you deliver it. And now you find there are mistakes and you have to maintain it. You've got to add new features. Reuse is supposed to reduce the effort in here, less effort to build code and so on, less effort to test, but it adds new things. We've got to find reusable components that will suit our needs. From looking at our specifications, we've got to say, well, we've got to guess what kind of things might already have been done. These days, the answer is quite a lot of things. You've then got to adapt them, possibly by putting stuff around them, less desirably by changing them. And then finally, we've got to update these reused components. Now, when would you update or adapt? Reusing doesn't always mean reusing somebody else's code. It can mean reusing your own. Okay, one of the things you will do as you go along, you will build up your own personal library of things that you've used, the problems that you've solved, and you'll say, okay, I need that thing again. I've got a hash table thing that I wrote back in 1980-something, and I'm still using it. It's pretty good. I mean, I make tweaks to it, but it's still basically the same thing. Even better, when you go looking for reusable components, you might want to revise the requirements around what you found. If you find, for example, that some particular... Suppose the client wants to use some sort of interface convention. Let's say it's Z39.50, that's the library thing. And you might find that there's less and less stuff available, that people aren't really supporting that anymore. So you might go back to the client and say, well, how about this new standard instead? Would that do you just as well? Because I can get code to do that that will talk to other people. There are too many standards for computer-to-computer communication. For health data, there's something called HL7. Weird thing. But we've still got the task of finding stuff and adapting and then updating the reused components, because sometimes you find that a component made assumptions that you didn't know about. There was something you were taking for granted that wasn't true in the new environment. so you have to generalize your code a bit. So what are some of the problems? One of them is poor quality. Just because it's out there, just because somebody says it's been reused, doesn't make it true. Okay. I remember once getting a compiler from a reuse tape and discovering that the actual parser module had been half written, and I literally mean half, it stopped halfway. You couldn't even build the program, let alone run it. Well, it was free code. It was worth what we paid. But is free code ever free? You've always got to pay with time. You've always got to pay with maintenance. And this leads to the next problem. If somebody gave you something for free, they don't really expect to get any benefit by fixing the code. Okay. If you've got a maintenance contract with somebody, they're going to get money if they fix things for you. If they sold you the code, at least they've got the hope that if they act like good guys and give you some fixes, that you'll buy something else from them. But if it's free, what if they just don't have time anymore? Okay. And I'll give you two examples here. Several years ago, Andrew Trotman and one of his students did some interesting work, but they had this graph. When I say graph, I mean nodes and edges. And it was this really cool 3D graph. And I said, wow, that's neat. How did you do that? And they said, there's this thing called UbiGraph. And UbiGraph was available free for download. Cool. And man, that was a lovely system. Lovely. But it hasn't been maintained at all since. It hasn't been recompiled to run on 64-bit machines. It's just been completely abandoned. And because it was provided in the form of object code, not in the form of source code, I can't maintain it myself. Okay, so this is an important thing about the free versus proprietary software. It can also happen with proprietary software. Okay, this university used to use ThinkPascal. And then Apple, on Macintoshes, that were 68,000 Macintoshes, and then Apple switched from the 68,000 chips to the Power chips. And ThinkPascal wasn't maintained. They said, okay, there's going to be no more versions. For a while, we could still run the old 68,000 code in emulation mode, but that stopped being supported. So here was this thing that we'd been using, and it didn't work anymore, even though we paid for it. If you could find an old Mac, it would still work, but you can't, right? So we got MetroWorks instead. And then Apple switched from PowerPC to x86-64. And MetroWorks wasn't supported in the new environment. So we ended up using GNU tools. Except Apple don't support that anymore, we've got to use Clone. What does this actually mean in practice? It means that if you depend on something made by somebody else that you can't maintain, and they go out of business or they otherwise lose interest in it, it's not going to be maintained. You're going to have to change to something else. So you've got to plan for that. You've got to say, one of the risks you've got to evaluate when you're building your initial requirements is what software are we likely to depend on, and how likely is it that that software will not be maintained for the life of our project? This is a really big problem for the square kilometre array. They're going to start building that next year. It's expected to be going. It's expected to be in use for 50 years. How much of today's software do you think is still going to be maintained in 50 years' time in a recognisable form? Well, I don't know what programming language they're using in 2067 will look like, but I'm sure it'll be called Fortran, or possibly something or other C. But this is a major problem. Okay, the graphics software that Quintus bought isn't maintained anymore. For that matter, Quintus Prolog itself isn't maintained anymore. They went out of business. It got bought by somebody else who maintained it for a while and then merged in the features that they liked with their own system and stopped supporting Quintus Prolog. So this is one of the arguments for using standardized programming languages and staying well within the standard. Okay. If something is in the standard for your language and your language is a popular one, chances are it's going to be supported for a while. If you've got third-party code, then as long as you've got the code, you've got a chance of doing something about it. And there's a business thing here. One of the things that some of our bigger customers did with Quintus, they said, we like the look of your system, but we think our company will outlive yours. What we want you to do is to put your code into escrow. This is a legal term, E-S-C-R-O-W. And the idea is if you go out of business, if you stop maintaining the product, we get the source code and the right to maintain it. So as long as you stay in business, we don't get to see a single character of it. If you go out of business, we get the whole lot. And that's actually a very good idea. Again, continuing with this idea of orphaning and whatnot, how many people here have done some Python? Okay, so you know about the difference between Python 2 and Python 3. And the idea that all the maintenance was supposed to be done on Python 3. Okay, but you know it's several years after Python 3 was introduced, and people are still using Python 2.7. In fact, I downloaded a new version of it a couple of weeks ago. The same kind of thing with Perl. Perl 5, Perl 6 is a radically different language. Perl 6 looks nothing like Perl 5. They want Perl 5 to die. I don't think it will, or at least not for a couple of decades. But another problem is that things may be coupled to their original context. They may depend on things in the original context. They may depend on libraries. So somebody will tell you typically, look, I've got this great library that you can use. Here, you can download it. Easy. And they don't tell you that you've got to spend the next 3 days downloading and installing 15 other libraries that it depends on. This is one of the reasons why we have package managers, things like NPM, the Node Package Manager for Node.js, Cabal for Hackage, Godi for Objective Camel, Cabal for Haskell, did I mention that one? We've got a whole bunch of these things. We've got .debians and .rpms, and we've got all these package managers that keep track of dependencies. And when you install a new version of something, they automatically pull in the other dependencies. But that only works if you've got the right to pull in the other dependencies. Okay? So you need, if you get in third-party code, you need the right to use everything it needs. You've still got to do your own tests, right? Because somebody may tell you something worked in your system, but you've got no reason to believe them until you've learned by experience to trust them. People will tell you anything. My elder daughter was very fond of The Sims, and when I bought her a laptop, I said, look, we've got The Sims 2. This laptop's running Windows 8. Can you tell me whether The Sims 2 runs under Windows 8? And he went away and came back 10 minutes later and said, yeah, no problem. Well, it didn't. Okay, and then we're stuck. If something that you've bought in doesn't work, it's not your fault, but it's still your problem. if there is some defect in the software that you're using in your project and it doesn't work, you have to deal with it. Obviously, you report back to whoever gave you the software and you tell them, hey, I've got this bug. But they will get around to dealing with it in their own sweet time that suits their convenience, not yours. You've got to do something now. This is one of my slogans. It's not your fault, but it is your problem. Another little example at Quintus. We were using a particular C compiler on a particular Unix box, and our program that worked everywhere else was misbehaving on this machine. And we disassembled the program and looked at it, and it turned out that it was something like this. The source code was needed a branch if greater than or equal to unsigned. The compiler was generating branch, it was generating that symbol, but the assembler was assembling branch if less than unsigned. Aha! So, of course we told them about the problem. Your assembler's generating the wrong instruction. We were not impressed by this. But we still had to work around it. We had to actually write a script that worked over the assembly code, recognized the badly compiled code, and patch in actual binary numbers to get the right instruction. It was awful. It wasn't our fault. We didn't break it, but we had to work around it. So how can we do reuse? The classic thing that's been done ever since the 1950s is reuse via the loader, which on Unix is called LD. We can reuse via text editor, as when we used to retype things we saw in magazines. We can reuse via a macro processor, and I want to show an example of that. We can reuse via inheritance, which is what Brad Cox was up to with Objective-C. We can use generics or templates, as in Haskell and Ada and C++ and Eiffel and a whole lot of others, aspects and generators. Now, we've got a lot of libraries in C, like the thread library, the math library. On these machines, they load the math library by default. That's not the traditional case. On some of the machines I use, you still have to say -lm on the C compiler command line if you want to pull in the math library. But if you want other things, if, for example, on the Mac, they've got some high-performance tuned numerical algebra code, Accelerate, I think they call it, and they've got stuff for vision and graphics and so on. You've got to explicitly load these things on the command line. But you don't need the source code. You're just combining existing bits of code with your program. So the components here can be data types, functions. Functions can have data parameters. They can have other functions as parameters. C allows us, Fortran allows us, Pascal allows us. They are traditionally not parametric with respect to types because you might need different code for different types. So you need, in order to support parametric types, you need to have some sort of pattern in a file that could be turned into code because it wouldn't actually be code. And you can't, using LD, rename things in either that you're using or providing. Reuse by the text editor is the classic way, and I must admit, when I use my hash table, I typically wish to tweak it in ways that I can't do it in C, so I find the last program I wrote that used it, and I copy it and make the changes. And this means that if I find a mistake in the current version, I might need to track it back through 3 or 4 versions. And there's a personal anecdote here. Rich use of your text editor is very easy, very obvious. And not doing that can require a lot of discipline, especially if you're working in a programming language that doesn't natively support the kind of parameters you need. So again, at Quintus, one of the critical parts in Quintus Prolog was the interface between our language and C, or Fortran or Pascal or whatever. And we had a separate implementation for about 5 different machines. So I spent a couple of weeks pulling these together into one file with parameters to describe, you know, parameters to describe the structure of the stack and what registers to use and so on. And so the idea was that there was this one master file, and then there were 5 tiny little files that provided the parameters, and you just put those together and you got exactly what you needed. And it was documented as to what these parameters were. A couple of months later, I came back and found that there were now 6 different copies. And they hadn't maintained it as a parametric thing, which means you find a bug, you've now got 6 places where you've got to look to see if the bug is in that copy. And so we've got the, you know, if somebody fixes a bug in, if we start with this version and we copy it to make that version, and we find a bug in this version, it's probably in the original as well, but there's no automatic link back. You've got to hunt down all the other copies and fix them. This is a pain in the proverbial. You know, we get duplicates of bugs, and you fix something in every place that you're aware of, and it turns out there are 3 or 4 other places doing the same thing. This is one reason why there's an agile programming slogan, once and only once. You should implement something once and only once, and you should use whatever adaptation mechanisms you can get your hands on to adapt that, because otherwise you're going to get this business of some versions will have a bug and some versions won't, and you won't know what all the versions are, and it's just going to be a pain. This is also the argument for dynamic linking. There are some very good arguments for static linking, and I think Andrew's told you about this. Static linking, you're in no doubt that the code you need is right there in your program. You're not going to depend on anything else. If I port that program to another machine running the same operating system, it's all there. I don't have to transport anything else with it. One of the things we can do is code interposition, where a bad guy can slip their library in between your program and the real library, and they can catch calls to a function, do something naughty, and pass other calls on to the real functions. You can do that in OS X, in Linux, in Solaris, and I'm pretty sure you can do it in Windows. If it's statically linked, that can't happen. So statically linked is really nice. But dynamically linked means that you can have one copy of the library, and every program that needs that library uses that copy, and if that copy is broken, you replace it with a new corrected copy, and now every program that used it is corrected, instead of having to hunt down all the proper programs that used the old library and rebuild them. Ah, dear. I don't smoke. I've never smoked. It's blood pressure medication. Reuse via the macro processor. This is basically what I did at Quintus. How many people here have even know what a macro processor is? Basically, a macro processor is a programming language, typically an interpreted programming language, that transforms text into text. It comes from the early days of assembling, where you would have an instruction and it wouldn't actually exist on the machine. And it would be expanded into multiple instructions, hence the name macro instruction. For example, on the PDP-8, the PDP-8 didn't have an instruction to load a variable into a register. It did have an instruction to reset a register to zero and an instruction to add a variable to a register. So the load accumulator instruction wasn't a real instruction, it was a clear accumulator followed by an add. So you write one instruction, you get two. So what we're doing here is programmed text transformation. Now, every Unix system since 1979 has come as standard with a macro processor. It is an intimate part of the GNU auto configuration tools, and it's called M4. And now why I wanted to go back here. Okay, so here's our example. It's not a very big one, really. So there's a random number generator. You know what a random number generator is. You call it and it gives you different answers every time. Deliberately. Okay, now it's the original version that I started from was written in a language called Ada. And Ada has explicit interfaces and explicit implementations in different files. So here's the thing. The lines beginning with double dashes are comments. And if you look here, it starts out saying generic. Then it says type supplied real is digits box. And so this is saying I have a parameter that is a type, and that type must be some sort of floating point type. Within the package, we're going to call that type real. So here we've got some constants, we've got some variables, we've got a procedure, we've got function random return real, we've got function random range with a lower and upper bounds that returns this type. Okay, so we can get different copies of this module for different types. Okay, so there's not much more to the interface than that, there's just another copy with the license at the end, which is how come I'm able to show it to you. Here is the implementation. Okay, so it says it's using calendar to get the time of day. It's using another library file, I don't know why. And in here, real is that type that was declared in the interface. And we've got something then that just looks like perfectly ordinary code, except that, here we go, here's random. So random takes no arguments and turns real. It picks up these, it's doing a lag Fibonacci sort of thing. So it's calculating a difference modulo 1, putting it back. Updating two pointers because there's the and then it's doing cycles here and so on. But this is, if we were doing this by text editor, we'd have one copy of this and then we'd make another copy for each different type of floating point number that we wanted, and we'd replace real with the name of that floating point type. Ada does that with this generic facility. So you write one copy. Okay. C++ can do the same thing. Now, what would we look like? What would this look like in C? Well, here's what the interface looks like in C. And if you say that's not C, or it isn't, it's C plus macro. So DNF, to start a new line, is a macro that says throw away everything until the next rest of the line. So here are commands you give to build the versions of these files. We execute this program with this parameter. So we execute this program with this parameter and we get this output, which happens to be C code. Just because a file is source code for some programming language doesn't mean it had to be written by a human. This is one of the most powerful techniques we've got, is the fact that we can have programs that write programs. So here, we're looking at type T, we're saying if it's float, define lowercase suffix to be F and uppercase suffix to be capital F, define lowercase. If it's double, do this. If it's long double, do this. Otherwise, default to double. So then we're actually generating C preprocessor commands as well. Okay, and so suffix, capital suffix, and tag are going to be replaced by other text. Okay. Now, I'm not pretending that this is easy. You'll see all these quotation mark thingies here that are a bit delicate. But when I run it through the macro processor, I get C that looks like this, in which there's no trace of the macro processor left. But not only that, I get three versions of this that have been suitably adapted in a way that I can't do in Java, because this is a primitive type. Okay. Similarly, the macro, the body, looks like this, and we've got DNL, which is a comment again. The second DNL shouldn't be there, that's just a mistake. We've got fdef, which is if t is defined, then do nothing, otherwise define t to be double. So here we've got what letter we're going to use in a scanf format, what are we going to use in a printf format. And so we've got things like we can read one of these things from a file. So we substitute inside a string, which is not something the C preprocessor will do. And again, we can print the thing out and we will substitute inside that string. And it wasn't actually terribly hard to write this, but it meant that I got code like this. I got three versions of this code, free. Well, I'd have to write one version, but getting three versions wasn't much harder than getting one. I just had to say, what do I need to change? And I want to change a type, and I want to change some names, and that's it. Okay? So this is reused via the macro processor. If you gave, now, case in point, there's an optional part of the C standard for decimal floating point arithmetic. And IBM make two ranges of machines that support decimal floating point arithmetic. Well, I didn't plan it, but I could get decimal floating point random numbers by using that same template and just plugging in decimal 32, decimal 64, decimal 128. Okay? I don't need to write a whole new file. And again, if there's one mistake somewhere, I fix it in one place, not in six places. That's reuse via the macro processor, and it's much, much better if you can do it with language facilities, but if you're using a language like C that doesn't have such facilities, or if you're using a language like Java where you need to plug in numbers and primitive types as parameters, which you can't in Java, then you can do that again with a macro processor. And I've got a whole Java, I've got an analog of array list for primitive types that gives me about, what, eight or so different classes from one template. Okay, so it's a bit messy, it can be a bit error prone, but and it's old technology, but it still works, and it gets a lot of the benefits of reuse, which is that it's not duplicating bugs. Okay, so this is where we'll stop today. We've got some more things to talk about later on. But, whoops, that doesn't work on this machine, does it? I think I should try and produce some more slides about searching. Okay. Possibly the most important thing to know about a programming language that you plan to use is there a repository somewhere of components you can use, like the comprehensive Perl Archive Network, Python eggs, Ruby gems, where can I find stuff that I don't have to write? Okay. So there are all sorts of repositories out there for